So one of the goals is to understand, try to understand our human behavior, psychology with neurobiology. And here I'm going to talk about the very simple psychology, not even psychology, just psychophysics, and try to relate that into what we know about the V1 neurons. So here's my outline. And this psychophysics is called the tilt artifact I'll demonstrate just now. And I'll talk about what people thought about the neural basis would be. Okay? And I saw that recently people actually went cat cortex and tried to actually record what neurons actually do in the situation when tilt artifact happens. And I show that this classical model is actually not correct. And then you have to be some modified model that actually reconciles the neural data and with tilt effect. And I show that what the significance of the new findings on V1 neurons would highlight the visual function. So let's go to a demo. I'll show you a tilt artifact. So just constant for a while, this slanted stripe is for minutes or so.
Do we have to fix it?
Just look at the center. You have to be a little tired. And what I show is that a vertical stripe and it's supposed to be tilted, and I want to test that if that works. It's a little short. It's supposed to look at 4 minutes and 2 minutes. Okay.
Okay.
I think it's relaxing.
Yeah, it is actually.
It kind of grows on you. That's true.
Yeah, it's like being in a train. Yeah.
Okay, so this is a vertical stripe. Where did it seem to be? Yeah, which way?
You
which way?
Quite right. Yeah, it's a little bit.
This is vertical, and where
it seems like it's tilted this way to me.
Yeah, it seems
like
it's tilted the same. It seems like this way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This way.
Okay, that's correct then. Okay. Okay.
It's not much.
It worked. Okay.
It's not much though. It's a little.
Yes, very little. It's supposed to tilt at most 4 degrees. Okay, at the most, and then.
Wait, are you supposed to see all of them tilted, or you see a superimposed pattern that's all like this and a little bit?
No,
of
no, no. They're all tilted. The old direction. Okay.
There are a few pathological people.
Your neuron is.
Yeah.
So, no, it's good that people actually Mozart actually said it to rotate this way instead of that way. Okay. So it's supposed to be rotate this way, and it's called repelling effect because you are adapting this, and then what you see is actually is going away from adapting angle. Okay, so this is a classical thing called the tilt artifact. This is when the days when people have no idea about what neurons do, and they just test on humans. And this is a psychophysics they call. And it's nothing to do with consciousness or anything. You have to see it, no matter what. Okay, all right. So let's look at the summary of the data. So it's actually first discovered in '30s. But actually, people also did experiments quite recently also. So it's been a toy for psychophysicists for a long time. And here's a summary. Suppose this is testing minus adapting, okay? And this is 0 to 90 degrees. And this is how much you see. So positive means just rotated away from adapting angle. And here is 4 degrees is where you actually see the most. It's tiny.
That's what
effect.
You showed, isn't it?
That's what I showed, yes. Yeah. If I show here, you wouldn't see too much. Okay, and in fact also there is a little attractive, it's when it's very, very far, that's a little attractive behavior. I'm sure these are all very averaged, very much, but it seems like these two subjects actually, given by Clifford. So how do we understand this? In fact, actually, if you think about the neural subject, it's actually qualitatively, it's a very simple story. Because look at the visual system. We know that from retina image, we go to LZN, V1, and the rest of the brain. And here, all these things do not really detect orientations. And the V1 is the very first stage where you actually detect orientations, okay? So the simple story goes like this. Okay, you're gonna adapt on all the on system. See that I actually showed you this moving stimuli? It's not still. Therefore, you sweep through your visual retina, so activate most of the retina cells. Okay, and the LGR neurons, they are not direction selective. So if you show such moving grating, all neurons will be activated. So they're fatigued equally. So there's no direction selectivity. Okay, only here, V1 neurons, because they are direction selective, they will be selectively fatigued.
So what if is there transfer between eyes and so on? Because if it's in V1, then it should be.
Yeah. The problem with that is that I don't know.
That's a more direct probe, right?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
have to argue about which area is doing the is first having orientation.
Yeah.
You just have to.
I think most people did it binocular. I didn't.
We can do it again.
Yeah.
You can be subject.
Yeah.
Right.
So, was Meister saying that you could get orientation selectivity?
Very weak.
Very weak.
Yeah.
So his adaptation is just really small.
Yeah. Very weak. Yeah. I mean, people also say LZN has some weak orientation selectivity, but it's nothing like V1. Okay. So for the first approximation, this is correct. You can argue about the very tiny corrections, and those can be. Okay. Okay, then what you can say is that, okay, V1, some of the neurons are selectively fatigued, okay? But the rest of the neuron, they just look at the V1. And if the response of V1 is distorted because of fatigue, then you're going to see the errors, okay? So that's a simple qualitative story. But we have to also explain the directions, right? So in order to do that, we have to go through the whole coding scheme, how the brain actually read V1 signal. So let's first look at V1 and see what is the current understanding of how the brain read out the orientation out of V1 responses. So this is a typical summary, idealized summary of V1 neuron. Okay. So basically, found by Huber and Weasel, if you show different orientation bars, then the firing rate of the cell actually show this kind of tuning curve. Okay, you can approximate that as a Gaussian curve. So this cell is this maximum firing rate corresponds to its neuron's preferred orientation. Okay, and there is a fall off when the orientation goes away. Okay, so I want to want you to remember this. All the stimulus orientation is used with phi. Okay, it's easy to remember, physical phi, physical stimulus phi. And the neurons are labeled with their preferred orientation when there's no adaptation. And the labeled orientation is called psi. Okay, psychic, whatever. Psi, okay? Okay, so that's V1 neuron. So how do we read out the orientation? Okay, first we have to, so for given orientation, there will be a profile of neuron responses. It's called a population response profile. Okay, so that's easy to construct. Basically, this is stimulus orientation, and this is tuning curve to each neuron. I show three neurons. One is, this is red, green, and blue. They have different preferred orientations. Okay, but when you show one stimulus, like a vertical stimulus right here, then you check out the firing rate of each neuron. Okay. And then you spread out, and here now is a neuron label, and you have the landscape of responding profile of the V1 neurons. Okay, that is population response profile. And the information is transmitted to the rest of the brain to read it out. Okay, so what are the reading out mechanisms? We don't know. Nobody knows. Okay, so but we have leading candidates, and that's what I'm going to show you. The first, the simplest, is called a winner-take-all method. Okay, so the idea is very simple. Each neuron is labeled. Okay, what you're going to do is that the rest of the brain look at a neuron response profile and picks which neuron has a maximum firing rate. I'm sorry?
That won't work right, because over there at the top, the curvature is zero.
Oh, no, this is actually, you have to think of this as population of neurons also. Lots of neurons actually have this same orientation.
But you have a curvature which is zero, which means that you're going to be making substantial
sensitivity error. Yeah. Yeah, because of that, because this is actually not accepted as the best possible coding scheme. I'll show others. Okay, I'm showing this because this is easiest to analyze, and actually the results are not so different anyway. Okay, for my purpose. So this is not even, there's no statistician who proposed this because this is such a simple scheme. People just say, you know, it's obvious. Okay, okay. So of course there's a lot of other problems because of it. But it's simple. It's a labeled line. It's basically people first guess is labeled line. Of course this is, wouldn't be the best. And here comes the citation, had a more sophisticated way of detecting orientation. It's actually using population vector method. Okay. So the idea is this. Okay. This is my population response. What I do is this. I take one neuron, and then I have this firing rate. Then I go to this plane, I just construct a vector corresponding to this neuron. Basically, this angle from horizontal to here is twice of its label, and then the length of the vector is the proportional to this firing rate. Okay? And for example, this neuron has this angle and then this magnitude. So each neuron here will contribute to one vector, and then you make a vector sum. Okay, and the angle of this is called population vector, half of it will be the perceived orientation. Okay, this is not necessarily correct, but people argue information theory, for example, have better properties than winner take all. But who knows if it's really the way it is? Okay, of course we can propose more, and this is one more. It's called a maximum likelihood, okay? In this case, actually, what's happening is that instead of individual neurons, actually the higher up brain area, they have their own templates, okay? They have, so to speak, shoes to fit in, okay? They have labeled templates. And then what they do is that they actually try to fit each template onto the population profile and see which one fits the best. Okay? The one that fits the best gives the perceived orientation. Okay? Because each template has the, its own label. For example, this would fit the best to this population and will give the label of this template will give the orientation. Okay? So there are so many different results, and we have to actually, to be anyway convinced that we can actually have something, we have to test all these models, okay? Because we really don't know which one is correct. Although people argue this probably is the best one, but we really don't know. But what I'm gonna present though, I will just rely on winner take all because the result will be the same, okay? It's easier to analyze. Okay. So let's see what is a classical. Before that, I just want to show another representation of this tuning curves and the population responses. So it turns out it's easy actually looking at this kind of surface. It's called a firing rate surface. Basically, there are two indices. There's a neuron label, psi, and the stimulus label, phi. Okay? And this means this neuron, given that stimulus will have this firing rate. Okay, that's simple. So here it summarizes basically all the tuning curves and all population responding curves. Okay, because if you hold the neuron label constant and then varies the stimulus in this direction, then you're going to get all these red curves, which are tuning curves. Okay, and if you fix a stimulus and then vary the neuron labels, you're going to get the blue curves, which are all population response curves. Okay, then you can see at a glance what happens to the whole population curve and the tuning curves. Okay, here I just plot the maximums because that's what I'm most interested. Okay, in this case there are actually two maximums. One maximum for tuning curve, red and the blue, but the blue and the red are on top of each other and is indicated by this pink line. Okay, let's see what is a classical explanation of tuned after effect, okay, given all these schemes. And I'll present this only in winner take all scheme. Okay, it's the same with other schemes. Okay, so before adaptation is like this. Basically, this tuning curve is the same as that Poplin's curve. No distortion, therefore the perceived and presented orientation will be the same. Okay. Now suppose we adapt this green neuron. Okay. What's happening is that this, at this orientation, this green neuron fires the most. It works the most. Okay. So therefore it fatigues the most. So its tuning curve will reduce the most, like this, okay? And this red neuron, it fires the second, compared to the green would be less, okay? So its tuning curve goes down less, okay? But also goes down. But this cyan curve neuron has really no firing at all, and there's no change really of tuning curves, okay? Now, if you look at this population responses, then you're going to see this. There's a symmetric distribution of population, okay? And this maximum is shifted, okay? So that's the perception error. If you say, if you present this to the rest of the brain, then this will show that, okay, perceived orientation will be rotated away from the adapting orientation, okay? So that's the classical explanation of two-dot effect. So it's easy actually to see in this curve also. I just showed one orientation just now, but if you on this curve, you can see it happens to all orientations. Because let's look at how this tuning curve changes. This population response curve changes, okay? So concentrate on where it intersect with the red lines. As you go this way, you intersect with the neurons that are very close to adapting orientation. Right now it's at zero. Okay. So therefore, this side of population curve will go down the most. Okay, and this side will change hardly. Therefore, the maximum will shift that way. Okay. So this is repulsive shift of this blue line relative to where the diagonal is. That's a two-dot effect.
So is the maximum tilt that you said was 4 degrees just then sort of related to how much adaptation you can have?
Yes. So it's related to the fatigue.
So you can't fatigue any more than that, say.
Okay. So I have to see the neurons. What the neurons do, right? Because this is just classical before people ever did the experiment on neurons, and this is their best guess. And it's a simple guess, and seems to be right. So now actually, let's look at what neurons actually do. Do they really fatigue, or something else happens? Okay. Of course, we cannot work on humans. So the only thing we can do is they did on cats. Okay. So this is a cat V1 neuron. So the protocol is not very different from what I just showed you. They showed the gratings for adaptation. And then this is just for testing orientation of tuning of neurons. Okay? So here's the result. So the red right here is the tuning curve before adaptation. Okay? So that's control. And then here, this arrow is where they adapted. This adapting orientation. And then the time effect, at 10 seconds, the firing rate goes down. Okay? And this curve, pink curve, is the tuning curve. And there is this fatigue effect. Okay? But after at 2 minutes though, this shifts. The preferred orientation where the maximum spikes actually goes away from the adapting orientation. Okay, and if you adapt more, 10 minutes, this shift is actually more pronounced. This is called also repulsive shifts of preferred orientations. Okay, so this is just a schematic summary of this effect. Basically, if this is adaptive orientation, if a neuron had, if this is a preferred orientation relative to adaptive orientation, then you're going to see the shift of preferred orientation after adaptation like this. It can be up to 9 degrees. Okay?
But this example is much larger.
I'm sorry? Yeah.
So you're saying, so Because everything in this figure that I see is consistent with the fatigue model, except you're just saying that the green curve, I mean, the shifting also seems consistent with fatigue, right? Because
yeah, there is a fatigue.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But then you're saying what's happening is that the green curve is the only one that's actually enhanced at say 45 degrees. It's actually enhanced above the red curve, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not the shift that's really weird; it's the actual enhancement.
No, you can think of this as actually. No, what I'm saying is that fatigue is about the amplitude, okay?
No, but fatigue also, I mean, it's also a function of rate, right? And the rates that have already gone to zero are not
going to okay. Right? No, okay, so fatigue model actually had a specific meaning that it's just amplitude changed, okay? So nothing, it's not about individual rates, okay? The overall rate, that's fatigue model. There's nothing shifts in preferred orientation. What the weird about this is that preferred orientation, where maximum is also shifted. So here is that, for example, after 2 minutes, actually the preferred orientation is happening here instead of there. But here, this at 10 seconds, that would be just precisely fatigue model, because everything just goes down.
Yeah.
But now here you actually have this shift. Okay.
Can you say it tend to be up to 9 degrees?
Yeah, up to 9 degrees.
Example, it's like.
This one?
Yeah,
that is because this is individual neurons. You know, V1 has variety of responses.
So this is the most extreme.
Yeah, this is like dramatic. They don't want to show this.
It's the typical.
Do they know where this neuron was located? I mean, they also mapped the neuron.
Yeah. So there is also pinwheels and domains and so on. And in fact, actually, there's more shifts in nearby pinwheels. And the domains have lesser shifts. And all this data here averaged actually is actually averaged over all neurons. And here probably it's from a pinwheel. Yeah. So there's also those subtleties, and I'm not going to deal with that. So the question is, what's the effect of this? We see two things. One is fatigue, and one is actual shift. Okay. So what does the shift really do? So let's actually naively look at if we just shift instead of fatigue, what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In fact, what's going to happen is actually the opposite of a two-dot effect, meaning that you actually see it's attractive rather than repulsive. Okay. So let's see why is so. So this is fine rate the surface I showed you before. So repulsive shift of tuning curves is like this. So this diagonal was the original height of this surface. But now you shift everybody this way, repulsively, and that will also shift the maximum of the population curves attractively, because all the maximums are top of each other and they move together. Okay, it's just like this. It's easier to see here. So this is your locations of the maximums, and this is your repulsive shift of preferred orientations, and they're going to move like this. But if you look at this way, which is to see perceived orientation of this stimulus, then you look less than what the true stimulus is, right? Okay. So this is actually opposite what the tilt after effect is. Okay. So what the hell going on? So basically, there's opposing effects. If you fatigue, you're going to see a positive shift. But if you shift the preferred orientation away, you're going to see negative tilt after effect. So these two cancel out. So then the question is, what? Exactly how much? We have to be quantitative to answer the question. Otherwise, we could not argue either way. Right? Okay, so we have to do calculations now. And we will actually compare with neural data and see if actually what you see in cat data actually can be quantitatively related to human psychophysics.
Can you just explain with two neurons, you know, like, I mean, this whole picture, right? Like,
yeah.
You set up the classical fatigue model.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And somehow it seemed more clear with the two figures. You're saying the classical model is just even wrong, even based on they just didn't reason correctly.
No, I mean,
even if this fatigue, it's actually going to move in the wrong direction.
No, fatigue will move to right direction.
Oh, but it's the motion, it's the shift.
It's the shift that removes
the fine is just getting smaller.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the fix. So I just said there's this opposing effect of fatigue and the shift. Okay, so if you have the shift this way, what you have to do to make tilt out effect? You have to really, really fatigue this neuron. Okay, if you really fatigue these guys, then again, even though they tend to be shift attracted, but then if you fatigue a lot, then you're going to actually force all these maximums to move away from the true stimulus. And again, you're going to recover the tilt out effect. In fact, actually, I can show you graphically that has to be true. And there is strong relation between the separation of these two curves. So positive shift of preferred orientation and positive shift of perceived orientation would affect how much you have to suppress. And here's the reasoning. Okay, let's start from somewhere, for example, in this tuning curve. Okay, so here, right here, this is neuron 1. This is the maximum of the tuning curve. So this is tuning curve, okay? So this plane right now is something I project. I'm looking at this plane right now. I projected this whole surface onto this plane. And this is two lines. This red line is maximum of this red dot, and the blue line is maximum of this blue dot, okay? Okay, let's start from this. If I start from neuron 1, okay, if you go this way, then I'm going to trace out the tuning curve of this neuron, okay? And I stop at where you meet this population response curve, right here, okay? Because this is tuning curve and this is preferred orientation, the firing rate has to drop if you do this. So firing rate at 2 will be smaller than 1. Okay, now you can do this iteration. Suppose you go this way. If you go this way, then the stimulus is constant. Therefore, you're tracing out the population response curve. Because this is the maximum, again, you're going downhill. Okay? So firing rate at 3 will be smaller than 2. And then this, again, is the maximum for tuning curve. And you can do this iteration. So on, you'll go to the 0. Okay? So therefore, you go this path will be downhill. Okay? And you can also see that the downhill will be pretty severe because this downhill is on Gaussian tuning curve. And this downhill is also on almost the Gaussian population response. Okay, and if this separation is a lot, then you're going to downhill a lot. Okay. So basically, I can prove that also with the simple mathematics. Of course, you have a lot of assumptions here. But if you do math like this, you can also show that. Here is the firing rate. I approximate each tuning curve with Gaussian. So a psi is the amplitude, and the psi n is the preferred orientation of neuron. Phi n is the preferred orientation of a neuron psi. Okay, and this is width parameter. Okay, so how do you calculate perceived orientation of stimulus phi? You just take a derivative, and the neuron with a maximum firing rate will give you perceived orientation. And the calculation is quite simple, but it turns out that it's very hard to actually solve the perceived orientation for given stimulus. Instead, what is easier to do is actually express the amplitude of the tuning curve in terms of where the preferred orientation is and where the perceived orientation is. Okay, so rather than try to go from amplitude and preferred orientation to perceived orientation, you actually expressing this way is easier. You can imagine it's very hard to invert this. But anyway, there is this quantitative relationship between the tuning curve parameters and the tilt out effect. Okay. So then we can actually check with this formula what happens in with neural data. But actually, we can simplify this. Suppose I simplify the tilt after effect curve with and the shift of preferred orientation with the piecewise linear. Okay, then you're gonna end up with this simple expression. Actually, it's actually amplitude, nearby, this adapting orientation will grow like exponential. It's like Gaussian, and the coefficient is given by this sum. Basically, this is amount of shift of preferred orientation divided by where it is happening. Okay, and this is the amount of the tooth after effect, and divided by which stimulus has the maximum tooth after effect. And you can see this is sum. Okay, so this is summarized everything I said so far. Okay, so so if this is a positive shift for preferred orientation and a positive shift for tooth after effect, you're going to have a big, large coefficient, and this change of amplitude will be severe. Okay? Okay, so let's look at the real fitting of the data. So what I did is that actually I took a tooth after effect and I fitted the curve so that I have this tooth after effect to plug into my equation. Okay? And also the fitted line for how much it actually shifts. So here you can see the variability of the neurons. There's lots of variability. And here's the width parameter. So what I'm going to do is that, given all these things, given the how much the neurons shift, the preferred orientation, and how much tooth effect they have, you'll be able to predict how much suppression there should be, okay? And that's what I'm gonna compare with the data.
And why do you fit the shift of the preferred orientation with that kind of curve?
Oh, because I don't want to shift. Okay, you might say it should be like straight line.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, but then it's weird that at zero, if the neuron is right at adapting orientation, then it shouldn't shift too much. Otherwise, it's like a symmetry breaking. It might happen, but it just theoretically seems to be weird. Yeah.
Excuse me, sir. Is the fitted curve a lovely rate of regression?
This one? This is just a, yeah. It's a regression. It's like a square error.
It's a locally weighted thing like EOS.
No, it's not locally weighted. You mean robust fitting you're talking about? It's not robust fitting. Yeah. It's just nonlinear fitting, basically.
Parametric.
Yeah, parametric. Because this is nonlinear function. Of course, here is not. This is just straight function. Here is also nonlinear function. It's a parametric fit. Okay. So let's calculate, and here's the result. And here is the neuron preferred orientation before adaptation, and minus the adapting orientation, okay, and this green curve, green dots are experiment data, and there's huge variability. You can see it from the error bars. It's large variability, okay, and I'm showing here four curves. The red one is calculated from Wiener-Tirkov method, okay, and the pink is something I calculated with the linear approximation, and the black is maximum likelihood, and blue is population vector method. Okay, and as you can see, all these methods actually give pretty similar results. Okay, and also it's quantitatively, or you have to say semi-quantitatively, agree with the data. Okay. Okay, let's for fun go back to classical model, and take out the shift of preferred orientations. Okay. And see if this amount of suppression you see is consistent with tooth after effect. And as you can expect, it's not. So here again, the greens are all the neurophysiologic data, and these dashed lines are all calculated without the shift of preferred orientation.
This is the most to sigma 4, there are 5 or 6 degrees of freedom. And this is going to be one.
Here. Yeah, you mean the statistic measure wouldn't be very, yeah, that's true.
You cannot say that these curves do not fit.
Right. Yeah, but you would agree that this is...
It's chi-squared of 1 per degree of freedom, that's...
Yeah, I agree, it's a statistic. it's not that statistically, you know, very, very robust because of the scatter. But yeah, but still.
Maybe because of the first point over there down there in the left, the pink curve is somewhat excluded, but everything else is everywhere, for every point it falls within the error bars.
No, but if, I mean, I totally agree that this is not significantly and pinned down. I mean, I wish that everything is very tight, but that's not the data.
Although you see the blue and black curves
miss
the third data point.
And they have to miss it by one second.
That's the way the Yuan data looks.
But if you tried to publish that and said my theory fits, even though it's not statistically different, you'd have a hard time. If you said this is my theory and these are the data and I agree that it fits, even though you're probably right that it may not be statistically different, no one would believe that was a good theory.
That's the point, exactly. So this is, I mean, statistically we wouldn't like reject the other theory, but this is clearly better fit.
It's consistent with the data.
What?
In the other curve there are assumptions that are not consistent with the data.
In reality, if you look at this next plot, previous plot, that point, whatever, 10 degrees, which is 3 standard deviations away, makes this whole thing substantially worse than the previous plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, there are wrong models that give
how many
right results for certain questions. That's what we have to do.
But then you cannot say that you have either explained or not explained the data, or that the model is better than the previous one.
You probably can say it's better. You could rank the models. Maybe
I don't know the numbers, but my suspicion is that this fits statistically worse than this fits in the previous.
No, it's not. It's not. What do you mean worse? If you calculate the mean distance between those lines to this data, it's much, much better.
Yeah, but they won't have much effect on the sum of the standardized errors. The first point, Inge's right, that first point is going to screw up the chi-squared calculation on these data, even though they look so good otherwise.
I guess you have to have more data. The problem is more data is that they just takes longer. It's all neural data, yeah.
Why is the error bar on the 90-degree thing so big? Because that's the one that sort of has this weird anti, right?
Yeah. It's close. Yeah. And also the number of the main problem is really that the number of data points is very, very small.
I see.
Yeah. So I wish actually you have more denser data so that you can actually. Can be very confident about the error bars, but that's not the case right now.
Are the degrees of freedom two types of models?
What do you mean degrees of freedom?
How many
it's the same thing.
The same thing.
Yeah.
And how many parameters you have?
I'm sorry?
How many parameters you have?
Oh, this is non-parameter fit. There's no parameter. What do you mean?
And we are fitting for.
Only those are inputs, yes. But these are very pinned down by data, and there's no other adjustable parameters. Oh, the other way, of course, the maximum, the relative size is something that there's no consequence. So therefore, you scale the relative height. That's the only thing. Others just from this data. It's nothing adjusted.
So you can move those curves up and down.
You can move those up and down,
If you move them up and down to minimize chi-squared, in effect, you might be better off in the first rather than the second model. Sorry, in the first set of models rather. So you might, if you just minimize chi-squared.
The first data point should be better,
No, it's just fitted over, tried to make the overall error smallest. So I didn't, because of others, you move up and down, but you don't want to try. The main problem is that I tried to minimize distance from these centers.
Yeah, but
weighted average.
Yeah, you may have to wait it with this error.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Then you get the chi squared.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Assuming you close everything to zero.
Yeah. The trouble is actually you can see the size of the error bar is different. It's not uniform. So
that's
yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, so the thing is, I asked my collaborators to get more data, but apparently that's just asking them to labor and many hours more. And it wasn't very, it's just an existing data, basically. So,
yeah, but then it gets to be not, you know, not a compelling evidence.
Yeah, 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 I agree, it's not completely compelling, but this is an analysis that you can provoke more data to be, you know, more compelling. I hope. I'm not saying this is very compelling, but at least it's more compelling than this. If I tell you this is a better model than this, this is a weaker argument than say this is a better model than the other. At least I can say that, no?
So you can stimulate experimental research.
Exactly, yeah. But this is actually, I have a paradigm where actually you can go out and do the experiment and really pin this down. Okay, at least I can show that. But agree that the data itself would be hard to distinguish or reject completely this model versus that. Okay? But let's look at directly the other way.
But also just qualitatively, these ones are, right, there's a peak, and the other ones there isn't, right? So there's this, there,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
45. So even just qualitatively, the question is there, you know, I mean, right? I mean,
yeah,
they're just qualitatively different.
You mean that the little wiggles and so on? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a data. I mean, it's a last point. 90 degrees. 90 degrees is plus or minus whatever, 0.3 or 0.4. It's as if it's not there. It's not considering the data at all. You don't know what the data has.
No, no, I'm talking about the prediction. I'm talking about the predicted curve.
No, those are.
I'm not talking about the data. Prediction. Predictions are qualitatively different, right?
You mean those are predictions? Are,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Prediction
yeah,
here
yeah,
versus the prediction in the
yeah,
thing
yeah, yeah, yeah,
are qualitatively different. One
yeah,
is monotonic, one is not.
This is this
qualitatively different, no?
I have to say that somebody has to do more experiment to get more data on this.
Uh-huh.
Then we can really pin down this, yeah. Okay?
Well, maybe you could throw some points away.
Oh, no, well. I don't want to do that. I just get data from them. Whatever it is, I just plug there.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be science.
No,
I would rather take a tax rather than being a bad scientist.
It's very honorable.
Yeah, but it's just reasonable to ask actually how homogeneous that sample was.
Yeah, there are also that's,
it does have a very large variance, so you might ask why it has such a large variance.
Yeah.
Try and tie that down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is a very simple-minded model. Look at the visual cortex. There's pinwheels, there are domains, and there's lots of direction selectivity, all these other things that I haven't talked about. It's a very simple-minded model to try to connect neural data to psychophysics. Okay? If you want to do it really correctly and with the mechanistic, then you have to do pinwheels, you have to lateral connections, there are lots more parameters you have to fiddle around. Okay? But this gives you this idea about what the two effects are, and they're opposing each other, and how much they're canceling each other out.
Can you play around with drugs or something that might you know, highlight one aspect of those two things versus another? And
I bet you can, yeah, yeah, yeah.
In that horrible point there, the last one on the right, there's not just one or two cells out of 8 or 10 that are making all the differences.
Yeah, there is. Only like, you know, like 5 cells there, and that's why that's huge.
But is there one that's an outlier? That's what I'm asking.
One, what do you mean?
A lot of times, everything will be just kind of all scattered all over the place.
Yeah.
A lot of times, there'll be 3 or 4 that are clustered, and one that's way off to the side.
Uh-huh.
And I was just wondering if that's what it was, which of the cases that last one was.
The last one was like more like a cluster here and a cluster there.
Too
yeah, yeah, something like that, and
of course,
the rest were way up also. The neuron that's way up and way down. So it was, that's why the error bar is so big. Okay, so to really pin this down, you really need more data than what I have right now. Okay, and the problem is that the experimentalists already wrapped up, and then.
Can talk about actually next.
I'm sorry?
Yeah,
he's already left, and I'm just looking to archive, basically. And that's a dead data. It's not that active, but somebody might do this if they care enough. Okay, I can do the other way around. Basically, doing numerical simulations, I mean, I did this way because you can express it analytically the amplitude. But you can ask, you know, what if I do the other way? Meaning that if I give the suppression and tuning curve changes, can you predict TA, you know, to the after effect, and how much that is different? And this is the result, okay? So the green lines are tooth after effects, okay, the data. And this blue, all this blue and all these different tuning codes, okay, dashed lines are those without preferred on-chain shifts. And the solid lines are with the shifts of the preferred orientations, okay? And here, all these solid lines agree with a tooth after effect. That is because I used those calculated amplitude, okay, for each method. So that's the way that they fit this tooth after effect. And if I use that suppression curve and get rid of the repulsive shift of preferred orientation, and these are results for tooth after effect, okay, which would be the fatigue model. And what you can see is that, as expected, the fatigue models give large perceptual errors. Okay, and you can see this winner-take-all model is even worse. Here is worse because it turns out that here you can actually have double-peaked, there's symmetry breaking, and you can have a double-peaked population response, and that immediately screws up the perceived orientation. Maybe that's why winner-take-all is so bad. Okay. But anyway, all these methods give you that there should be a huge perceptual error. Okay. Okay. So let's look at think about why this is why the brain has to come up with this shift of preferred orientation. I think what's going to happen is that this fatigue is something that has to be built in from all the way from retina to all the neurons. Okay. It's something you cannot really avoid. Okay. But if you fatigue that much, then how you can make your perception actually correct? Then the clever way is to actually shift the preferred orientations. Okay. So then the shift of preferred orientations is something that you can actually try to minimize your perception error. So it turns out that actually if you just adapt for a few seconds, for example, the fatigue is very large. I just showed you for 10 seconds, right? Fatigue is already very large. But if you look at the tooth after effect, it's very tiny, okay? So if you just adapt very, very short time, you don't really see tooth after effect. Only when you adapt like for 2 minutes, you're going to see tooth after effect. That's when I think what's going to happen is a shift of preferred orientation, which also measured by other people, happens within very short adaptation. So this fatigue and the preferred orientation shift actually goes hand in hand and try to cancel out, okay?
But I thought that in the figures you showed, like the first thing that happens is just a suppression, like a fatigue, and the time scale for the shift is slower, no?
But yeah. Again, that is something
that's
that...
Okay, that's also just poor.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's one neuron.
Another people did experiment on monkeys.
Yeah.
And they showed for very short, like 500 milliseconds to 1 second adaptation. And they also showed that there's a shift of the preferred orientation. Yeah. And psychophysically, there's no tooth after effect. Psychophysically, what's happening is the tooth after effect, as you adapt to longer time, it grows larger. Mm. Yeah. So that seems to fit also in that sense. Because at the beginning, although your fatigue is there, and shift is there, and they cancel out. But at the time you adapt a lot, the fatigue would take over, and you can just shift it that much. And eventually, your tooth after effect will be growing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this, I think, is a design that tried to minimize effect of short-term tooth after effect. So we can just think about where this fatigue would come from. Where is this adaptation were mostly effective? That would be in cortex because of the reason I talked about, because you're sweeping this stimulus across all LZN cells, all neurons will be active, they're fatigued equally, but V1s are fatigued separate. So we think this effect might arise from lateral connections between the V1 neurons. Okay, but if you do try to do this with, for example, purely lateral connection models, then it wouldn't work because it will shift too much. Okay. All right, so that's my very short talk. Basically, I think the neural data is consistent with the repulsive shift of preferred orientation with the tuned artifact. Okay, and the repulsive shift is try to minimize the orientation tunings, minimize the perception error when there's fatigue. Okay, so that's the conclusion. So the data is from Valentin Dragoy and Murganka Sir lab. And Sebastian Sung also worked with me.
So the shifting of the preferred orientation of the cell is presumably some network effect from neighboring inhibition or something like that, right?
But
then, so you're saying the shifts are actually canceling these effects of the fatigue.
Yeah,
so reducing the
error.
Gain. But then you would think that in the pinwheel centers, where there's more inhibition from other orientations, you would have you'd have greater shifts and less TAE. So you actually see more TAE. Is that right?
But the thing is, the perception is serving every neuron. It's a population response. So it's not local neurons that tell the perception.
So you're saying it's a pooled effect.
Yeah, it's a pooled effect. Yeah. I see. So in this, all the neurons I've been showing you, really, those are actually, you can think of the average neurons.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of those as all the neurons with the same orientation. They averaged.
I see.
Okay.
But neurons that are in the pinwheel center do show greater shifts.
Yeah. There's a because they have different connection structures, for example, so their shift will be different.
But you wouldn't be activating the pinwheel center so much because usually at the end of the pinwheel center, the spatial frequency tuning is either very high or very low.
So they'd be
So you'd be out sort of in the middle of the pinwheels with the spatial.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The excitation intensity would be in the center.
Okay.